needs to keep ourselves going here. We're going to go into part two in a moment, and we're going to show you another part of the DVD, Darwin's, Darwin's Evolution. That's right, a very unnatural selection. One of the things we've done in producing this is to deal with the sort of criticisms that we often get thrown against us, and that is there are no real scientists, no published scientists who believe that biblical creation is true. So you're about to see some of those who've got a well-established reputation in this field. You won't see them all because we haven't got time to play the whole DVD, plus play me as well out the front. So once that's done, we'll sort of transfer the equipment across, make sure this is right. Then we'll have part two of my section dealing with the evolution, the biology, etc. And then we'll have a last chance for questions. But I'm here tomorrow, I believe. Twice. 10:30 and 6. So there's no good television on at those times. So come and join us again. Tomorrow's programs are totally different. Tomorrow morning, have you advertised the topic?
Yes, it's on the Word.
Oh, okay. In the beginning was the Word. That's right. Yes, so we'll be looking at the creation of the universe and who did it, how, etc., and the importance. And tomorrow night, we're going to be dealing with an aspect. Remember last night, those of you there, we looked at the giant kangaroo that we excavated up there in Queensland. We're going to be looking at there were giants in the land because we found lots of fossil plants and animals, and they are much bigger in the rocks than they are today. So the point we made last night, change is true, but it's not evolution, is something we'll be considering, and you'll not only get a lot of fun out of seeing some of the big things and the rocks, but you should find it very helpful as well. And tomorrow night again, you'll have time for questions. Are we ready, young lady? Thank you. Let's play, and I'll go and tell you when the next bit is.
Such design and relationship cannot be produced by naturalistic evolution. It is widely promoted in the media that all published scientists believe natural selection and mutation through time are sufficient to explain the evolution of life. So let's meet some published scientists who actually believe the evidence demands a designer, and they are brave enough to say so.
One of the things that, as a chemist, I would try to, if I could illustrate this for you, is I have a rock here that took me about 40 minutes in the hot Okanagan sun to find. And you'll notice that it has a zero in it. That represents 1/26th of our alphabet. And this is naturally formed, and we have no problem with understanding this as being naturally formed. But if I told you that I had found this rock, and it took me months or maybe years to find it, you might not believe what I'm saying. You see, at what point does naturally formed disappear and intelligently formed start to appear in your mind? Hopefully you can see that I made this rock. And there are two reasons why you should be impressed with this, and that is that it has information on it that you could not think of a mechanism of how this might happen, and the information on it is correct. And really that's what's happening with chemicals in terms of evolution. We're told a story that says that the chemicals of the cell spontaneously formed, and then they self-assembled into a cell. Now the problem is, sure, you can make chemicals react with each other. I make my living doing that. I'm a synthetic chemist. But I also understand the limits to which chemicals can react. And really, making chemicals is kind of this situation, where you can naturally form certain simple type molecules. But to put them together into something complicated that has structure and function is more like this particular rock. And this is intelligently formed and designed. And that's one of the reasons why I don't believe in evolution, because complexity and information always come from intelligence.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and boost ignition, lift off of Space Shuttle Discovery.
Well, I worked for 31 years at Boeing in aerospace engineering, and I found out when I worked on the space vehicle, the navigation, guidance, and control was very sophisticated, probably the most sophisticated in the world. And yet when I found the navigation capabilities of birds and butterflies and turtles that were, I believe, more sophisticated than ones that I had designed, and I just couldn't believe that I could not do anything compared to a warbler navigating from across, turning corners, literally, by the stars. When our navigation capabilities were trying to navigate by the stars, we got confused by the space shuttle putting out a little puff of gas and screwed up our star scanner. And so it just was amazing to me that I couldn't design something as sophisticated, and it got my attention. And even more so, as time has gone on, I find that sophistication is vastly more complicated than no one had ever dreamed of.
Design is obvious everywhere in the cosmos. In our example of solar system, that's just a small demonstration of how everything in cosmos follows certain patterns and rules. And those rules and patterns are telling me that there must be a designer who is setting them up and who is putting these things in motion. I'm not talking about the creation of things only. I'm observing cosmos, and I see that every little thing, every little speck of dust is following certain rules and is submitted to those laws. We can see that all the planets are following that one and the same law. We're able to predict their locations, positions, with amazing accuracy.
When I was a student in university studying genetics, we were taught about the junk DNA, which is a huge part of the actual DNA. At that time, the thinking was it's just really a junk, there is no real information. And nowadays, when we look at the scientific literature, nowadays the scientists started to realize that it is not junk anymore. There is so much information in the DNA, even in the junk DNA. This information has to come from somewhere, not just the property of chemicals, but it is the arrangement of these chemicals. And this information really cries for a designer, a creator.
Dr. Chava Shafel readily accepts that the same intelligent design needed to create these artificial plants shows in the DNA of the original living plants. This plastic copy is made from atoms of carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, none of which possess the ability to organize themselves into artificial plants. But this living plant is made from the same atoms which provably do not possess the ability to even organize themselves into DNA, no matter how long you give them. And that information-rich DNA makes for one vital difference. Real plants make copies of themselves. The information the DNA uses to make baby plants is not actually from the chemicals in the DNA, but from the way in which the chemicals are arranged or organized on the DNA. Just as the information and the arrangement of the Morse code is a key evidence pointing to the intelligence of its creator, Mr. Morse, so the information and the arrangement of the DNA code is a key pointing directly to the evidence of the existence and the intelligence of its creator.
I think the thing I find most convincing is design. And that is design in nature, design that we see, of course, in the whole universe, in the galaxies, in the solar system, in the things we see in the earth, living organisms. I mean, the cell structure, of course, is very convincing. The fact that it is so complex, there's just no way that you can explain that by random mutations and natural selection, which is what the basis of evolution is. I'd like to focus on a particular task that I worked on one particular time in the development of a large system, a lander to land on Mars. The Viking program was, as we were developing a proposal to propose a system to do that. There's a great deal of technology involved in such a complex design problem that we very often miss. And the reason this is significant is because the most complex design problem I can conceive of is the one of designing the human being. the complexity of doing this for a simple mechanical gadget like a Mars lander alongside of the marvelous complexity of the human body convinces me that there is no way that the human body could be the product of an accident. It's absolutely marvelous the way the Lord has put together such marvelous.
Deal with the issue of design. Full time in Christian ministry, one deals with the issue called Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, and where Dr. John had just got to about designing the human body, you want to follow that up, you'll find that superbly done on here. It deals with the human body and all the bits that have to actually interact at one time. Not over, they just can't accumulate slowly, they have to begin all together. And the other one deals with how do your ears actually work and your eyes, and how many systems and subsystems are needed there. They're both brilliantly looking at the evidence that the human body is not the result of random chance processes over vast amounts of time. Now we're up to pressing in the right numbers, hopefully. We've got a fair way to go yet. Let's see. Catch up, Mr. Bill Gates. Hurry up there. Okay. Those of you there last night, remember we took you through the biblical history, and we'll do it again on Sunday night, where your Bible says the world didn't happen by itself, but it has changed since it was first created. Darwin's theory is a theory of change, but the type of change he's talking about is exactly the opposite in most cases of the real change the Bible says occurs on planet Earth. For illustration, we're going to take you to a dog show. For those of you a little disturbed, this one is the dog. That's the owner of the dog. The reason I picked the dog is that this dog here, we know from our records, has been bred from the same common ancestor as these two hairy chaps. All right? And these two hairy chaps have been bred from the same common ancestor as this little chap. There's also wonderful evidence that the longer you have your dog, the more you look like it. And don't say I made that up, it was in the medical journal. Seems to be some truth to that statement. But of course the current wisdom concerning dogs is that they have been bred from the grey wolf. And the grey wolf is classified genus Canis species lupus, translated as the big grey dog if you like. And there is the pronouncement at the American Association Advancement that the ancestor of all modern dogs seems to be at least three pairs, six grey wolves. Okay, I've got no problem with that thesis at all. Start with a grey wolf. And we have managed over the past many centuries to produce big dogs, little dogs, ugly dogs. We've got them as big as the Great Danes and as tiny as the Chihuahuas. We've even got them as good-looking as my dog, okay? Canis lupus familiaris, a subset of the Canis lupus group. But if you've been following dog breeding, you will know very well that the dog breeding clubs have also got themselves into quite a bit of trouble, because look at the varieties they've been producing. Voted the world's ugliest dog. Evolution or degeneration? What is it? You see, many people see all change as evolution. But in reality, they're in trouble, because this turns out to actually be degeneration. But let's put Charles Darwin's glasses on. You go to America, you see a type of dog you haven't seen before. So you give it the same genus name, but you actually give it a different species name, Canis latrans. Then you go to Africa, and you see a black-backed jackal. So you say it in Latin, like black down the middle of its back. Obviously a canis, a dog variety of some sort. Then you list them all. Red wolves, Canis rupus, grey wolves, Canis lupus, domestic dogs, golden-backed jackals, black-backed jackals. Notice most of these have been found living in separate parts of the world. Of course, by Darwin's day, you then accumulate all the information because you're trying to tell me where all these different species came from. Notice his full title, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favoured Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, beyond a shadow of a doubt, Charles Darwin looked around him. He saw he lived in a world that was kill or be killed, and he made the assumption the world has always been like that. Now, last night when we began our conference, we reminded you that Genesis says God, who was there, claims it wasn't like that. It started very good and all the creatures were vegetarian. So there was no struggle to survive and there was no kill or be killed. Things have changed. But Darwin, here's what he's taught us to do. We define evolution as change, whether we mean to or not. You see, when I was a student at high school, the concept was simple to complex. But then it was very evident that that couldn't possibly be the only type of change. Because some creatures seemed to go from this island, the wind blew them to that island, they lost their wings. So the flightless parrot in New Zealand must have lost wings. So it can't go from simple to complex, sometimes it must go from complex to simple. So therefore, they scrapped the simple to complex definition, and then by the time I took up genetics at university, they were saying evolution was a change in gene frequency. Some for wings, some for without wings. Change in gene, some for dark moths, some for light moths. And then some very clever person said, well, hang on, if we have 10 million people in a big room called planet Earth, and you kill 100 of them who are black, you've changed the gene frequency. But nobody or nothing has evolved. So that definition has gone by the boards. This one is the only one that's really left to describe everything the evolutionist is talking about. But then you do what David Attenborough does and National Geographic. You call all change evolution. If the moth's numbers have changed, must be evolution. Then you accept any change. Okay, a dog with a black stripe down its back must have evolved from a grey-coloured wolf. Then you tell me if dogs can end up with black stripes down their back, then the dog kind wasn't created. That is the logic the evolutionists in National Geographic or the state high school curriculum are following. But here's an interesting phenomenon. When the British first brought Canis lupus familiaris to Australia, and then we discovered an Australian dog. You know our native dog? Not really native, you can find them in the Sandhill Hills of India, the dingo. But it turns out, different place, different name, different species, but our dogs from England can breed with it no trouble whatsoever. Many species, in reality, they are in essence one kind. And the question that was asked to me before about what a kind is a good question. You see, as in Old English, kin, as in related to each other but not related to non-kin or separate group, e.g. mankind. Now I remember being invited into a big high school and the principal said, this is a government high school, you can't bring religion in here. You can do science. Oh, that's fine. Do you mind if I ask them a question? He said, no. I said, well, can you show me their textbook, their biology textbook? What chapter are they up to? And he opened it up. He said, they're up to the evolution of mankind. I said, that's all I need to know. Oh, I know the question now. So I went into the classroom. I said, okay, all you year 12s, who can tell me what evolution means? Okay, E, out of, volute, to shape, I-O-N, state of being, state of coming out of. Useful definition. That's the picture built into the word. I said, good, you've got it. Some of them said monkey-like creatures turning into men. Some said, you know, reptiles growing feathers and turning into birds. They knew pretty well what evolution was about. And then I said, okay, tell me what mankind is. I said, well, come on. And they said, you're one. I said, yes, I know, but what am I? I said, well, look, does anyone know where the word comes from? You knew your Latin roots for evolution. How about mankind? They didn't know. I said, well, I'll help you. Our word mankind, you need to know that English actually and ancient Sanskrit overlap. You can read the following story in the Vedas. There was a person who was so righteous that Manu and his seven spiritual helpers were allowed to survive the big flood. And when Manu got off, all the people on the planet are descended from him. So by the time we said that in Old English, we were the C-Y-double-N of Manus. Of course, you know English people like to play with words and shorten them and flip them around. Now the word has become mankind. The relatives of the person who got off the big boat after the big flood. By this time, the headmaster was looking very angry at me. Interesting. I'm not surprised Jesus said you'd be judged by the words out of your own mouth. You can't help it. We describe ourselves as the descendants of Mr. Noah. Biblical sense, bird kind was originally created separately and unrelated to the fish kind. I did a debate on the BBC against Dr. Andrew Parker, who was doing research for the Royal Society, and he, like many people in England, was saying, well, look, the order of events in Genesis and in evolution are the same. I hate to tell you this, but you've got to have such a superficial knowledge of Genesis to even believe that. See the two I've picked here? You will find on day 5, the birds and the fishes are created on the same day. In the theory of evolution, the fishes are there hundreds of millions of years before they crawl out onto the land and turn into reptiles who 150 million years later turn into birds. And in fact, you will find the grass is here before the birds are here. In the evolutionary story, the grass is not here till after the dinosaurs are here. So the events in Genesis don't match the theory of evolution in any way, shape or form. So how are you going with your thinking? You see, Charles Darwin was the first to suggest a way to falsify Genesis. If what he said is true, then this was untrue. If Genesis is true, and it says 10 times that creatures are made to produce after their kind, then that is what should be the history of the planet. If you start with a dog kind, after 100 million years, it should be some kind of dog. It's so simple, really. But if this is true, you could start with a jellyfish, and after 100 million years, it could be some kind of dog, correct? So please don't tell me there's no way to scientifically sort out the difference between these two. And I'm just giving you one example. There's my conclusion after many, many years of studying this. There are plenty of opinions and theories that disagree with absolutely everything in your Bible, but the facts don't. If you know of any later in our question time, feel free to bring them up. I might be of some assistance there. Hands up those who were down the mountain last night to our first session. Good. Well, look, you're going to get a little repeat, but because you've got a short memory span, you need to see the same thing as we did last night, because the others definitely need to see it. What sort of change do we see? Remember, I reminded you I debated Professor Steve Jones, University College London. He was on the BBC, and I commend him for telling the truth about this little aspect here. He was asked, is human evolution over? And the interviewer says, look, we've got bigger brains than we ever have. Is this trend going to continue? And he said, well, look, to be frank with you, I don't think so. The odd thing is we certainly have bigger brains than chimpanzees, but we have smaller brains than Neanderthals. Okay. Who has got the biggest brains? Courtesy of our supporters, we purchase scientifically accurate casts. By the way, these are accurate inside and outside, and they're worth a small fortune. Cro-Magnon on the left, Neanderthal in the middle, modern man on the right-hand side. Remember we showed you last night that Cro-Magnon has an average cranial capacity of 1,600 millilitres? Neanderthal, average cranial capacity 1,450, and you and I, average cranial capacity 1,350. And I labelled this brain drain. And of course, it's led to the John Mackay theory of computer development. Guess why I think we need another brain on the outside these days? Because this one's running out. Oh, by the way, that's change. Larger brain space, smaller brain space is a change. But that's evolution. And I insist that our theory of small brains becoming bigger is not actually based on any evidence at all. Biggest fossil people I've seen are up here. I've seen many pygmies down there. Okay, Charles Darwin's theory is a change. Somewhere the data has to say that. Your biblical picture says the data is going to fall into that sort of a trend. I have to smile as I read through some of the accounts in Genesis. Most of us have so been programmed to see it as a religious book, we never look beyond the religious bits. There are religious bits in there. They're necessary. But there's also bits about the weather. Do you remember that it first began to rain in Noah's day? Al Gore was way too late to come across the concept of climate change. It occurred long ago. But there's also information about what Noah built to survive the big flood. Now, you ponder the intelligence involved in that story. God comes to Noah and says, "Hey, Noah, build an ocean liner." Noah says, "Okay." Can't you see the funny side of that? I mean, he should have said, "Me? Ocean liner? I haven't been to boat school. Why me?" Ever tried to build a boat? You see, the rest of the story is intriguing. How many health and safety permits did he apply for to see if he could get permission to build this? In fact, how many times did he load it up with the animals to see if it floated while it was full? In fact, how many lifeboats is he recorded as having put on it just in case it sank? Interesting. And this is not just a little boat. This is that big, that high, that wide, one window, one door, and it made it float. And it was the biggest boat ever built in the history of the planet up until last century, for all practical purposes. Oh, and in case you think we have been evolving for a while, then consider this quote. You see, I personally got into severe trouble from Dr. Strawn for quoting him. He said I was using him out of context. But you two can look up the original. The issue is the same as it was for Steve Jones. Have we stopped evolving? Because since you've been born, you haven't seen anybody evolve. In fact, I'll be blunt, you haven't seen anything evolve either. Professor Ronald Strahan was mad at me because I just applied his quote in a way that he never intended. Evolution had come to a halt, he said, not because we'd reached perfection, but because we'd stepped outside the process 2 million years ago. Okay, my questions were simple. How many scientists were there 2 million years ago to watch it when we were evolving? Answer, none. If we haven't seen ourselves evolve in 2 million years, how many people have ever seen humans evolve? Answer, none. If we haven't evolved for 2 million years, then we haven't evolved. Correct? Yeah. Because he didn't like that application. He thought he was being scientific and I was being purely fundamentalist religious bigot. Let's continue. The BBC has come to your help. On a program when I was over there a couple of weeks ago called Material World, they've discovered evidence that women are evolving. Let's show you what it is. They've been doing a study of 14,000 ladies in Massachusetts, published October 21st, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Their evidence, women who had more children, number one, started earlier, number two, had more body fat, number three, were shorter, number four, stopped later. Now, I shared this with quite a few ladies' meetings and most of them said, "We already knew that. Why did they spend $400,000 finding this out?" Okay, well, there's the evidence they collected. Here's the predictions. By 2409, the average Framington woman will be 2 centimetres shorter, 1 kilogram heavier, have a healthier heart, have her first child 5 months earlier, and enter menopause 10 months later than a woman of today. Probably could be right. But look at their conclusion. That rate of evolution is slow and pretty similar to what we see in other plants and animals. My question, what evolution? I thought they started with women and they predicted the women were going to turn into women, but the women would be shorter. And they predicted that women who are having children would end up being women who are having children. Now, do you see what they're doing? If they increase the average number of children, if they get marginally shorter, then that's a change. And if evolution is change, then we've just proved evolution. And if we've proved evolution, the Bible is false. That's what they're doing. Because if that's the same rate of evolution we see in all other plants and animals, then I'll be blunt. We're not seeing evolution in anything. Change you might be seeing, because isn't Australia subject with some of these weird little local climates? Aren't we seeing creatures die out? It's a change, but it's not evolution at all. Look, you want to see more? I'd encourage you, go and have a look at our search engine. Click on evidence search. Click on brain drain. You will enjoy what you read. Or better still, subscribe to our free electronic newsletter. Creation Research is not Creation Ministry, so if you want material that's different, then have a look. It's all free. You will also come across lots of information. We've hardly talked about Noah's flood or about the fall or anything like that, or how did we get to be different skin colours, or why do some people have eye shapes that are Chinese and others of us don't. There's all sorts of areas of questions you can ask in the next 30 minutes or so before our time runs out, but I'm getting close to my conclusion. You see, there's what we said. You want to set out and test. And I'll be honest, the God who I've come to know as my Saviour is not afraid of you checking anything he says. Test me, try me, prove me this day, he said to the people of Israel. And he extends the same offer to you. Seek for me with all your heart and you will find me, he says. He's not afraid of you doing that. The Bible says 10 times in Genesis that God made creatures to produce their own kind. You want to test that? I predict that in 100 years' time, orchids should still be observed to be turning into orchids. But since we're made in the image of God and God is the creator, we may have even figured out how to make life in a test tube. And if we do, we will have proved it doesn't happen by itself. It requires an intelligent creator to actually make it. I don't think we'll get very far with making life in a test tube. I don't think it'll crawl up to the top and say, g'day! All right? Because you'll be too busy copywriting it to make money before even letting the thing escape. Well, there's where we started. New Scientist, start of this year, said Darwin was wrong. Now, don't hear me wrong. It's not that they wanted Darwin to be wrong. Grab the magazine, read it yourself. Every author there is an evolutionist. But here's what they've done. They've taken Darwin's family tree, you know, the one that supposedly connects us all up, and they said, if this is true, can we find it where the rubber meets the road? And it didn't matter which discipline they started from, the answer turned out to be it's not actually there at all. It's here in our heads. It's not out there in the rocks or in the real world. I've gone one step further. Darwin was wrong because God is always right. By the way, he's rarely politically correct, but he's always right. Okay, there are plenty of theories and opinions that disagree with the Bible, but the facts don't. Now's your chance to ask me some questions about it. If you enjoyed the DVD you saw, get parts 1, 2, and 3 of it. They are available up there. And if you want a great encyclopedia on this stuff, then I'd recommend have a look at Dennis Peterson's book. He began life as a museum curator for the secular museum system in California, became a Christian. That is a marvelous museum in a book. So if you haven't seen fossil people, he's got fossil people in there, he's got dinosaurs, he's got all sorts of stuff done as a museum for you and your family. Okay, it's now 5:25. Has anyone got any questions? I've saved 5 or so minutes at the end to give you my punchline for the day. Yes, sir. The world of science, you know, the concept of peer review? Okay, have you been following the kerfuffle with the climate change stuff on peer review? Where you are now reading the emails, snitched, snatched or deliberately leaked, we don't know which at the moment, by the guys who are pushing the climate change barrow saying, we must prevent any alternative opinions being published. All right? So number one, what you find is that if any group, and this is a human failing, not a scientist failing, any group who gets into a position of controlling the output of information, if they can stay there, they will. It's a human failing. We all tend to do that. So that I have experienced it myself. The last time I gave a lecture to the Sydney Basin Coal Conference, Professor Ian Plimer had been appointed to the head of the committee, and whilst he got appointed there, I am out. I cannot publish anywhere. You can read my papers up to that date. After that date, I'm out. For the simple reason, even though I was producing articles on rapid coalification, he knew the next step was, if coal doesn't take millions of years, then you don't need vast amounts of times to deposit it in the rock. And the next step is, hey, we're back to Noah's flood again. Right? So you will find peer review in the hands of people who have a barrow to push becomes a very political weapon. And the climate change issue is really demonstrating that at the moment. And it's more or less like that in certain other fields. Geology is one. And I'll tell you how I discovered it. I was asked to do a debate against Dr. Trevor Emmett from Cambridge, Geology Department. And he had a reputation as an atheist who took no enemies prisoners, right? He was out to kill you. And I thought, well, gee, that makes me prime time target number one. But then as I looked at it, I thought, well, he's no slouch. He's quite bright. And I'm not the world's biggest dodo. So the problem can't be the evidence. What is the problem? So I deliberately went and I dug out the oldest book on thinking for geologists. It's almost unknown these days, but the name of the book is Principles of Geology, 1831, by Charles Lyell. Now, Charles Lyell gave us geologists a new way of seeing things. It included concepts like this. If you stand on the cliffs of Dover, you see the chalk being deposited in the sea at a certain rate. You divide that rate into the height of the cliff. Ipso facto, it took 100,000 years for that material in the cliff to be deposited. If one cliff took 100,000 years, then the whole world must have taken millions. And therefore, the world is too old for the Bible to be true. But in this edition, which was published by the University of Chicago, the professor had put in a little footnote. He said Charles Lyell's motives were unwritten in his original, but they can be found in his private correspondence, ipso facto. So I got the references. Quote, unquote, my aim is to free science from Moses. Now, there is the hidden agenda that they should have told me the first week I enrolled in geology at Queensland University, that I was being taught a study in which the whole thing was prepared in a way that I would never see any evidence that was designed to put any interest in the Bible. To give you a couple of examples, if you look up any textbook, it will tell you a fossil is a preserved remains of a plant or animal older than 10,000 years. Excuse me, sir, why isn't it older than 8,000? Why have you picked 10,000? In the end, you'll discover, guess which book they can stretch back to 10,000 at the most? The Bible. Moses is the first book. You want it outside of Moses, you have to define it as 10,000 years or older. And that's the only logic. Right, so therefore there is a hidden agenda, and if that controls your peer review, then anything to that exception is ruled out. You know, as I said, I've got personal experience on how savage this can be. And so does anybody. Anybody who becomes a creationist, a known creationist, is really throwing his life on the line. Peer review will eliminate him from getting anything published. Sad, but it's true. And sadly, as I said, it's not a science failing, it's a human failing. Everybody does this when they're in charge.
Do you not have a similar agenda trying to reconcile science with creationism?
Yeah, but my agenda is quite open. It's not hidden. So that when I was at the University of Derby taking a biology lecture for them, I said, I stand here as a Christian, right? I don't want you to not know that, and here is my purpose for saying what I'm about to say. Right, so once they know that, and every student is entitled to know what your agenda is, otherwise they can't evaluate the data you're actually giving to them, because it may just be politically wrapped up and I've left out the bits that would be embarrassing. Right, so yes, I have no problem with your statement at all. It's quite accurate. Yes.
I know that you're a
Okay, well, us geologists don't do much digging on the stars yet, so I have no what you'd call factual data that's derived from my own studies that is helpful to you. But again, I'll give you back to the methodology problem that's involved that occurs in all of these fields. Remember the man I mentioned, Charles Lyell, Principles of Geology? Now, you will find that after he gained the ascendancy, the age of the Earth did this, and then the age of the solar system did that, and the age of the universe did that. Why? Because all of us wear his glasses. Illustration, on planet Earth, it's much easier to demonstrate this. Carbon-14, radioactive substance, decomposes at a certain rate. We assume that whatever it's doing now, it's always done. Charles Lyell's principle of uniformitarianism, which he devised, unknown to most people, to get rid of Moses. Why? Because Moses said, hey, one moment there was no carbon, let alone carbon-14, then the very next moment God had invented the universe. Right? So you can't assume it's always been doing its thing. One moment there was no uranium, next moment there was. So therefore, you've got a logical method, but it's a limited method, and if you don't know the limit, you'll get a logical answer. It's just wrong. It's easy to demonstrate with carbon-14. When it gets to outer space, here's what we do. Two things. We assume that if the light is coming from the star now, it has always been doing the same thing. Where do we get that concept from? Charles Lyell. Charles Lyell's aim? Get rid of Moses out of science. What does Moses say? Hang on, there was no light in the beginning. There was even light before there were stars. Day one, God said, let there be light. There's no stars till day three. So if you assume the light you're seeing now came from the stars, God may have a totally different perspective on that. Secondly, when you have a look at the next bit, Professor Einstein, currently just at the top but very shaky. All right, I think he's just about reached the end of his being at the top of the physics pile, because his philosophy is light has a fixed speed that cannot be exceeded. Okay, so you then use this argument. The light travelling over that distance has been travelling at the same speed from the same spot ever since it began. So even if you believe it started at the same spot, we now know you can actually speed light up. And it wasn't the physicists who found this out, it was the fellows who figured out computers can only go as fast as the speed of light. So if we can speed light up, we can make computers work quicker. Who cares what Mr. Einstein says? We're here to sell computing. Right? And so they figured out ways to make it increase, and it's really an interesting set of experiments that they've actually gotten involved in. So the minute you've broken those two paradigms, all of a sudden the problem itself disappears. To illustrate it in one last way, I had a physics professor come to me and she said, it can't be as simple as what you say. The world can't have been made, or the universe can't have been made in just 6 days. I said, what's your problem, Madam Professor? She said, well, the Big Bang Theory says. I said, excuse me, Madam, did you say the Big Bang Fact? Or did you say the Big Bang Theory? All right? And at that point, she got so mad because her whole story, which did disagree with Genesis, right? Her whole story contradicted Genesis, but it was all theory. It wasn't fact. So to resolve your question, no, I don't know the answer to that one yet. Being a geologist who digs up rocks and smashes things, I'm waiting for a smarter Christian creationist astronomer to come up with that. But you'll probably find the beginnings. There's a book up there by an astronomer called Taking Back Astronomy. Have a look at that and see what happens in the next 20 years. We're a long way behind the eight ball in quite a few fields because Darwin's had the running up until the 60s and 70s. Yes? What the word theory means in a scientific context. Well, it's changed its meaning quite a bit. So if you do a biology course these days, they will start off by saying, we are going to investigate the theory of evolution. All right? No problem with that. But by the time you get to the end of the first page, they will have said, 200 million years ago, dinosaurs began to appear on planet Earth. Now, all of a sudden, you've moved to history as facts. Right, and the biggest problem most people have with theory is a few times saying it and it turns into fact. Right, it should never be regarded as fact. Right, theory is just a contrived explanation to try and come to grips with the amount of data you have. A new bit of data, you might have to change your theory totally. And that's what a theory should be. But when it comes to this issue, it almost never is. Look at any textbooks. They start with the word theory. Within half a paragraph, it's fact. I mean, you just talk to the professor of evolution like Professor Dawkins. Evolution is just as much a fact as gravity. That's how he goes.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be impertinent, but can you tell us what you think the word theory means in science?
I just told you.
Well, no, you didn't.
It's an explanation which is meant to explain an accumulated set of data, right? You know, that is already stated in the text. You can get the quotes. But anyway, that's what it is. And so if you get more data, you need to change your theory or it confirms it. Yep. Say that again. The fact in terms of this world is what you perceive that becomes testable over and over again within the limits of your knowledge, right? So if I'm dealing with it as a scientific person, I end up with all sorts of dilemmas, because if something is absolutely true, a scientist can't absolutely prove it, because our current definition of science includes this little parameter. Science is any naturalistic explanation, right? That's where the science... It's got words like heuristic, repeatable testability, and the last line is this, without reference to God, right? Which is, by the way, a reference to God. So scientific theories are, by definition, agnostic or atheistic. The minute I got into a science classroom and said, well, God said, you can't do that, that's scientific. Oh, Darwin said, that's okay, right? There's really no difference in the construct at all. So when you have a look at a fact in real world, there's a body on the floor. It's dead. Facts are easy to demonstrate, right? If you don't believe, give me a gun, I'll pull it, put it through your head, and I'll demonstrate dead to you anyway, right? So reality, facts in the real world, you have to isolate them from the way a scientist tries to deal with facts, but he's limited by the paradigm or the box he's trying to play games in. And his box is defined to keep Christians and creationists out. It's one reason why I do not believe the intelligent design movement will get anywhere, right? Because they are failing to define how they recognize design and who is the designer. They want to play in a box called naturalistic science. Now, naturalistic means everything has to be natural. No reference to the supernatural, supranatural, supranormal or anything, right? Okay, you want to play in that box? Go and play games in that box. But don't tell me the world is that box, right? And so therefore the intelligent design movement wants to play in that box to prove the world was created. Can't be done, right? Because the explanation will be accepted, will rule out creation in any way, shape or form. Yes, sir. Do I know of occasions where information has deliberately been withheld? Other than the climate change debate. You will discover that information can be withheld by A, not being accessible to everybody, but B, mostly through what's presented in textbooks as if it is information. So most of you are familiar with, say, Haeckel's embryos, right? Now, Haeckel's embryos... The first guy who drew them up was taken to court in Germany in the 1870s for fudging information. He lost the court case, but nevertheless his textbook diagrams appeared in my textbooks when I went to high school. That was one reason I thought evolution was true, because if we started out with tails and gill slits and then we lost them, that's the history of evolution. And then by the time I did a debate against two of Australia's leading atheists, the debate was, is evolutionary science reliable? And the subject had to be a college textbook. There is the diagrams again in 2007, right? So something's wrong, because you see the man who took the photographs of the embryos, Professor Richards, His data appeared on the front page of the Time Science section in 2004, if I remember correctly, right? There's the photographs of the embryos. You know what you notice? They don't have tails and they don't have gill slits, right? And the dog ones are different from the people ones, are different from the chicken ones. And Professor Richard says, these have been frauds, fakes, right from the start. So that's one way in which data is withheld. Because all scientists who, as I said, we did a survey of professors in biology in England, and the majority of them had three reasons for believing in evolution. The one I dealt with here was peppered moths, but the other biggest one was Haeckel's embryos. So here you have the whole clientele at the top of intellectual agenda, and they are living in ignorance. So they are withholding it, not intentionally, they just don't know any better. Okay, next question. Well, let me sneak in a commercial here again. You will have some driving to do on the way home, and up the back we have some CDs. Some of them deal with current issues like the prophet. Is it Muhammad or Jesus? This one here deals with myself and Ian Taylor, a science historian in Canada, on all the questions we get asked. Now, these don't come with pictures, by the way. Some of you are old enough to remember cassette tapes. They've gone by the boards, correct? And these are reaching the end of their limit, except in your motor cars. Most motor cars have CD players these days. For the young, those of you under 25, go to our main web and download them as MP3s. That's what most young people do. But if you are having to travel, I'd encourage you, have a look at all the materials you can get on CD, and instead of wasting your time listening to this or that channel, can I encourage you, do some of your biblical study and some of the stuff on Facts for Faith. I'd encourage you, make use of the CDs that way. Okay, we've got time for one more question before I finish my punchline. Yes, sir. In Africa. Type of bomb. Okay, do you realize that the only facts you've given us are we have a place in Africa with a lower percentage compared to all the other places? That's the fact. The explanation is, if the dating methods work on this deposit, then one way of explaining it is 2 billion years ago, here's what happened to the missing bits. That's an explanation. That's not a fact. Right? The explanation depends, first of all, on Lyellian logic. Whatever uranium is doing today, it's always done. Lyell was out to get rid of Moses. Moses said once there was no uranium, next moment there was. So the conflict is in the bits that you think are facts, but they're not. They're interpretations or explanation. So you have to ask where you're getting your assumptions from. And in this case, it's Charles Lyell again. So don't be surprised you conflict with the 6 days of creation. That's what Charles Lyell set out to make you do. He just was never brave enough to tell you that's what he was doing. But he's done it really, really successfully. The next thing I'd encourage you to do is go to our main website, this one here, and click on the search engine, then insert evidence search, and then insert uranium or radioactive dating or Lyell, because we are now getting to the problem that's a practical one on how do we dispose of radioactive waste, which is also radioactive, and given our understanding, should be radioactive for ages. What are we going to do with this stuff? So what scientists have been working on is, are there any ways to speed this up? And we've discovered now quite a lot of ways in which if you change the physical parameters, the things we thought of as impossible to change, They actually change quite quickly. They change seasonally. They change according to temperature, right? And it really is phenomenal. So rather than, because I'm beginning to run out of time, go to that website, insert in the evidence search uranium, radioactive waste, dating, Charles Lyell particularly, and you'll get a lot more information on that. Your uniformitarian says whatever something is doing now, it's always done. No, here's how it has to do with it. You see, you have a look at the uranium, you assume that its rate of decomposition from A to B is a fixed value, and it's always been fixed. That's where you got your 2 million from, or your 2 billion, right? That's Lyell again, right? Sure it is. No, it wasn't, but the physics has accepted Lyell's parameter that whatever the uranium is doing now, it has always done. Charles Lyell, it will get rid of Moses because it's designed to do. The modern physicist, in order to work backwards, accepts Charles Lyell's parameter because there is only one other alternative. You had a witness who was there, and the current batch of physicists don't like the only other remaining witness, e.g. God, because Charles Lyell wasn't a witness. Charles Lyell gave you an assumption, which is naturalistic and leaves God out of the picture. Okay, you can come and talk to me afterwards if you like. I've just got a couple of points to make, so I try and finish on time, and you know you can reliably come tomorrow on time and finish on time. One atheist said this 30 years ago. Christianity has fought, still fights, and will fight science to the desperate end over evolution, because evolution destroys utterly and finally the very reason Jesus' earthly life was supposedly made necessary. Destroy Adam and Eve in the original sin, and in the rubble you will find the sorry remains of the Son of God if Jesus was not the Redeemer who died for our sins, and this is what evolution means. Then Christianity is nothing. By the way, I'm sure Pastor will agree with me, that guy understands Christianity. He really does. That is exactly what the biblical message is. God made the world very good. You are accountable to him and you can't blame him for any mess you've made of it. When he handed it into our keeping, it was perfect. Genesis 3, we blew it. Adam and Eve sinned. And the rest of the story is the revealing of God's plan to save us from our sin. When Jesus got to planet Earth, do you remember the Bible says he went round doing good? Most people miss it. But you see, when Jesus died on the cross, do you remember anybody who could accurately accuse him of doing anything bad? Nobody. And God has an interesting little rule that begins with Adam. The wages of sin is? Which means if you sin, you will die, but if you don't sin, you shouldn't die. And if you don't sin and you do die, you are not dying for your own sin, you're dying for somebody else's. Destroy the story of Adam and Eve, and the whole life and death and resurrection of Christ becomes meaningless nonsense. This guy is 100% right. But don't be surprised. Look at the way Jesus said it. People don't believe Moses and the prophets. They will not believe even though one rose from the dead. Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, creation, the flood, the fall, the judgment on sin. You don't believe those, then what Jesus did won't make any sense. Even if he had a fabulous resurrection. Can I encourage you, if you are here today as a non-Christian, your problems are probably not with Matthew, Mark, Luke and John and Jesus doing nice things to people. Your problems are probably back in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy. So feel free to hang around for a little while and talk to us. Come back tomorrow if you're a Christian. Can I encourage you? If you want to deal with people who claim to believe Moses but they don't, e.g. Muslims, then can I encourage you to get familiar with what Moses actually taught? Because they call Muhammad the prophet, correct? That's because Moses said, look for a prophet just like me. He'll be the saviour. So all you need to remember is which country Moses grew up in. Which was it? Egypt. Which country did Jesus grow up in? Egypt. Muhammad never went there. Very simple, actually. But that's why I'd encourage you not only to know your Bible, not only to make use of the material up there, but realize the seriousness of this. People who don't believe Moses, like the Islams really don't, actually don't believe in Jesus Christ at all. Oh, and if you claim to believe in Moses, do you realize if you're like me and you're a geologist and you have millions of years in your head and Jesus says something like that? Twist it around. If you claim to believe in Jesus, then he's just committed you to believe who? Moses. take it seriously, because on Judgment Day, whether you're a Christian or a non-Christian, he's going to hold you accountable for exactly what he's revealed to you. Pastor, close our day in prayer, and folks can come and talk to me after that.